Thanks, Brother Cameron, and dear brethren and sisters, and dear young people. In the last session, we saw the true greatness of the Lord. We saw the strength of character of that man, how that he could look Legion in the eye, and he could sort out his problems. And then when Legion clung to him and he wanted to accompany the Lord, far from being flattered by it, the Lord, in his clearness and objectivity, said to Legion, "No, go back to your family and friends. Go back to your own town and tell them what great things the Lord's done for you and how, brothers and sisters, he had compassion on you." And we saw how the Lord does have compassion and what form that compassion can take. And it's a mark of the Lord's strength of character and greatness that he could do that without flinching, without apology. And that's a very hard thing, brothers and sisters. And I confess I found it hard because I know it did hurt. But I would remind you, brothers and sisters, that when it says he told that man to go back to his friends and family and tell them how he had compassion, the Lord was pointing out that what he did was kindness. To leave that man and to not do what he did would have meant he would have stayed exactly as he was. And he never would have found the relief and the joy that he did find. Let's remember that. And now we're going to see another mark of the Lord's greatness. Now we're going to see a comparison of two kings and their individual style of government. We're going to see how the Lord possessed that self-control, that objectivity, that largeness of mind, and yet the interest and the influence over men that qualified him above all others to be king of the world. It's going to be a remarkable chapter indeed. It begins there in chapter 6, in verse 1, telling us that he went out from thence and came into his own country, and his disciples followed him. He came into his own patrida, as it means, his own country, that is, his own homeland. That's Nazareth, his hometown, and his disciples followed him. Because, you see, he's about to teach them that the master leads, that the servant is not above his master, and that the master, in his turn, will lead the way by showing his servant how it should be done. Verse 2, when the Sabbath day was come, he began to teach in the synagogue. And this marks the last occasion in which the Lord is now to enter into the synagogue. It marks the end of that synagogue house cycle which we spoke of. And in fact, it's fascinating to notice that in the previous chapter we find him at once in the house of the ruler of the synagogue, and there's almost this intermediate phase where the cycle goes from going to the synagogue to the house, synagogue's house, and more in the house, until in chapter 5 we find him in the synagogue ruler's house. Verse 35, while he yet spake, there came from the ruler of the synagogue's house certain which said, and in verse 38, he cometh to the house of the ruler of the synagogue. And it's almost as if there's a transition, and now for the last time he enters into the synagogue in his own hometown. And many hearing him at that time were astonished. They were astonished at his words, unable to account for those things which he said, and for the remarkable effect which had come over this man whom they thought they knew so well. And they asked three questions: from whence hath this man these things? And what wisdom is this that is given unto him, that even such mighty works are wrought by his hands? And verse 3, is not this the carpenter, the son of Mary? So they say, where did he get this wisdom from? From whence? And what wisdom is this? It can't be his, because we know him. We saw him grow up. We saw him go to school in this town. We know his parents. Is not this the carpenter,
You see how familiarity breeds contempt? He's the carpenter. We saw him working in the carpenter shop on the street. We'd go past day by day. He was there. He was part of the town. How can he be like this? Where did he get this capacity from? We never saw it develop. And so they scorned him for that. In verse 3 they say, "Is not this the carpenter, the son of Mary?" And notice Joseph doesn't get mentioned. Was Joseph dead? Or does this indicate perhaps a hint of malice in omitting the father's name? And they were offended at him, we're told in verse 3. And it's the word scandalon, the word which means to stumble. They stumbled at their own prejudices. And it's always the way, isn't it, that our own prejudices and preconceptions can often get in the way of clear judgment. And again, a quote from Dryden, who said, "The people's judgment is not always true. The most may err as grossly as the few." And so it's true that here was all of the town, and they all thought that they knew Christ, and therefore they discounted what he did. But Christ, with characteristic philosophicalness, simply says, "A prophet is not without honour, but in his own country, and among his own kin, and in his own house." You know, that was a common experience of all the prophets. Think of Joseph amongst his brothers. Did not they scorn his dreams? What about Moses? "Who do you think you are, Moses, that you set yourself up above the others?" And what of Jeremiah? All these men experienced this. And again, even the Lord himself is a victim of this same prejudice. And so we're told that in verse 5, "He could there do no mighty work." He could there do no mighty work. What? Was his power withheld from the Father? Did the Spirit flee him? Did it cramp his style? No. It's not that at all. He could have solved the problem easily and done what they demanded. He could have done the great miracles that he did in all the other towns. And that's what they said. "Look, why don't you do the great miracles that we heard you did down in Capernaum?" He didn't. He could have flaunted his power. But this wasn't the time for triumphal homecoming. This was not the time for vindication. That's yet to come. You see, this is the style of Christ's greatness. It's not his style to flaunt his power, to show off in front of his home, you know, the hometown, to come home triumphant. No. To the contrary. It became the very reason why he held back. He was morally bound to withdraw. And yet we're told in verse 5, it continues, "save that he laid his hands upon a few sick folk and healed them." You see, despite the fact that he pulled back from showing off and flaunting his greatness, this did not prevent him from showing private compassion. It didn't change the basic character of the man. He still felt that compassion, but instead, he made sure that he privately healed those people that had need. And he laid his hands upon them, a recurring expression in Mark that refers to the way in which he identified with the feelings of others. So that feeling of compassion or identification was still there. And even though there was cynicism in his own town, that cynicism didn't stifle his largeness of heart. There's no bitterness in this, is there? What would we have done? How would we have felt? Would we have taken our bat and ball and gone home? Would we have left them and said, "Well, you can rock"? Not Christ. He found those people that had need and he healed them quietly. Here's a man who could have the power without the glory. We're told that he marvelled in verse 6
he marveled at their unbelief.
He privately marveled at their unbelief. They might have been astonished at him, but even the Lord could not believe the prejudice that he found in his own hometown. Don't you get that, brothers and sisters? When you're tempted to feel bitterness, when you think that you're a victim of cynicism and prejudice, just remember the Lord. Even he was shocked by the prejudice of his own hometown. And he went round about the villages, teaching. The little hamlets, the farmlets around about Nazareth. He visited them and he preached. You know, this man was not too big for the small efforts. And then we're told in verse 7, and then he called unto him the 12 and began to send them forth by two and two and gave them power over unclean spirits. He began to send them. And you know, this is the only occurrence of the word apostle in the Gospel of Mark. This is the apostleship of these men, the sending forth of the disciples. And so is the beginning of what is the most intensive preaching campaign of his ministry. But why did Christ choose to return to Nazareth? To almost certain rejection. He must have known what the prejudices in his own hometown would have been. Why did he choose to go back to Nazareth? Why did he choose a failed special effort in his own old hometown to launch the most intensive preaching campaign of his ministry? Because that's what's going to come now. He sends forth the 12 by two and two and gives them power, and they go forth to preach the gospel in the most intensive preaching campaign ever. But he launched it on the basis of a failed special effort, and his disciples had followed him and seen his humiliation. Brothers and sisters, they saw him humiliated before everybody, rejected. Why did he do that? And why does Mark record that for his Gentile readers? Well, one, it was an example to the disciples of the patient persistence necessary as they went out and faced possible rejection themselves. Secondly, it proves to the Gentile reader that this movement was no mere partisan movement, a patriotic insurgency against Roman rule, a rebellion of zealots from Galilee, but it was based on higher ideals, seeking the higher good, and it had a wider appeal. It wasn't as if Christ went back to his own hometown and whipped up further against the Romans. The Gentile reader could see clearly that this man was rejected by his own hometown, and so his teaching holds a deeper meaning than mere human conflict. It comes to touch man's relations with God. The third reason is that it demonstrated the superiority of Christ to all other pretenders to greatness. His quiet humility and his objectivity are an illustration of the fact that true greatness has got nothing to prove. So the disciples went forth on that intensive preaching campaign, that great gospel effort, parallel to the sort of things that we do today, town hall lectures and great leaflet drops and newspaper advertisements. This was Christ's preaching campaign, and it began with that failed special effort in Nazareth. It's not the way that we would have planned it, brothers and sisters, is it? And I can imagine what the ecclesia might have had to say about their gospel committee or their arranging brethren if they'd organised it that way. But in Christ's wisdom, that's how he did it. And we're going to see that this is what distinguishes him as being so much superior to all other pretenders to greatness. In verse 14, as a result of this intensive preaching campaign, King Herod heard of him, for his name was spread abroad. And he said that John the Baptist was risen from the dead, and therefore mighty acts do show that forth themselves in him. Now this King Herod is not Herod the Great. This is Herod Antipas, who's a descendant of Herod the Great, and we might just have time to just switch this transparency on. You get a bit of an idea of the convoluted family tree of Herod. The Herodian dynasty was a veritable minefield. There it is. And here is our friend Antipas, right down here. You see, Herod the Great had all these wives: Doris, Miriam, I think that says, Miriam the Second, Malthas, Cleopatra, Pallas, Thedera, Elpis, no name. Salome, the Third. All these wives. And as I said, he murdered ones like the tragic Mariamne or Miriam. He murdered her, and he was pursued ever after because she was a loyal and wonderful woman. And he murdered her in a fit of rage and jealousy. And he was obsessed by guilt over these things. It's interesting, just after the previous session. But here's our friend, what did I say it was? Herod Antipas. You see? Right down here. And half of these people were married to each other, one way or another, because of course there were half brothers and half sisters all the way through. So there's our friend Herod Antipas, and he seems to have inherited much of the paranoia and obsessions of his father, because we're told here that when he heard of Jesus Christ, he said, "Oh, it's John the Baptist. He's risen from the dead, and therefore mighty works do show forth themselves in him." He sees, like his father, is haunted by the imagined spectres of those that he'd murdered. And it's interesting, isn't it, that he believes in the resurrection. And that belief in resurrection aligns him with the Pharisees. Remember chapter 3. And so he says in verse 16, "But when Herod heard thereof, he said, 'It is that John whom I myself beheaded.'" And that's how the Greek would literally read. And you can see the Greek has the emphasis of a man in the grip of a tortured conscience. And as a man obsessed by guilt, he sees his crime reflected in every circumstance. And that's the way it is. Everything that happens, it's my sin, got me again. And he's tortured by this. "It's that John whom I myself beheaded." Verse 17, it picks up Herod's own emphasis. "For Herod himself had sent forth and laid a hold upon John and bound him in prison for Herodias' sake, his brother Philip's wife, for he had married her." He'd bound John in prison in that grim castle of Machaerus, east of the Dead Sea. And Edersham has this very interesting section where he describes a traveller's journey across the east there, over beyond the Dead Sea, where he found an ancient ruin. And he looked down and he saw in the midst of that ruin the rocks that formed a dungeon. And in the wall of the dungeon there was still the remnant of a rusty spike to which was anchored an ancient ring. And it conjured up the awful torture which poor John must have endured, shut away in the depth and the darkness of that dungeon. There he was, bound for Herodias' sake. For you see, Herod, like Ahab of old, was the weak, superstitious and dissipated tool of a ruthless and vindictive woman. Herod had met Herodias, his half-brother Philip's wife, at a party in Jerusalem. And she had actually convinced him to marry her and divorce his first wife, who was the daughter of Aretas, the king of Arabia, Petra. Petra, of course, over there in the east. And so the daughter of the Aretas, the emir of Arabia, Petra, fled to Machaerus, from where she was rescued by her father and taken back home. And Aretas didn't forget that slight, and we'll find that that caught up ultimately with Herod. And there's Herod now in the grip of this ruthless and wicked woman. And what was to account for John's imprisonment? What had John done? Well, John in verse 18 had said unto Herod, it is not lawful for thee to have thy brother's wife. Well, what authority did John have to say that? It is not lawful for thee to have thy brother Philip's wife. Well, what authority did John have? This, brothers and sisters, as friend of the bridegroom, no one would have had a more intense interest in this issue. No one would have been more sensitive on the question of marital fidelity. And it's ironic, isn't it, that the one who says, he that hath the bride is the bridegroom, and he must increase, but I must decrease, should meet his end over this very issue in this way. John was only to ever hear the voice of the bridegroom. He was never to join the festivities at that time. And so Herodias, not Herod, Herodias in verse 19 had a quarrel against him. And that word quarrel means an inward grudge. The Diaglot translates it even more strongly. She was incensed against him. She was jealous of her position. She guarded it. And such a woman, as the Proverbs tell us, is more bitter than death itself. And she would have killed John. And again, the Greek tells us that it's literally, she had a settled wish to kill John. She kept seeking, another translation tells us. She kept looking for ways to get John and to kill him. How like Jezebel she seems. But Herod, for his part, in verse 20, feared John, knowing that he was a just man and holy, and observed him. And when he heard him, he did many things and heard him gladly. So you see, Herod feared John. In other words, he was in awe of John. He knew that he was in the presence of a great man. Perhaps John spoke of resurrection and judgment. And Herod trembled, like Felix later on. And this might explain some of Herod's paranoia after the death of John. For we're told that he knew he was a just man and holy. So even the depraved Antipas, low as he'd sunk, could not help but be impressed by John. So that he observed him, or even the margin says he kept or saved him. And we can imagine the sort of tension that might have been in that household. Here's Herodias, chafing at the chain like a fierce watchdog, dying to get her teeth into John, and Herod constantly trying to hold her back. You can imagine the tension in the household, that here's Herod trying to save John, and Herodias is snarling to get at his throat. We're told that he heard him and did many things. He did many things. And we can imagine that John told him about the things that were required by God of him. And Herod did many of those things, we're told. But unfortunately, brethren and sisters, he did many things, but not the one thing that was needful, as the Lord said. And isn't it so true in our own lives? It's easy to do some things in the truth, the things that Yahweh asks of us. There's lots of things that, some things are easier for me, and there's other things that are easier for you. But like the Lord says, there's always the one thing that's needful that we can't quite come to grips with. Like the young rich man that couldn't sell off his goods because he was in love with them. And so here's Herod. He's stalled, isn't he? He's stalled in his spiritual development. He moved, he's done a few little things, but they're only tokens, they're the easy things, not the one thing that was needful. But he heard him gladly, made him feel good. You know the situation, we can all do it. And there's lots of people in the world that can do it. Yes, I meet people like this all the time. They love to talk about God and the Bible, makes them feel real good. And then they go away and they do nothing at all about it. They don't change a bit. And Herod was like that. He heard him gladly. Another one of these people that mistake ventilation for repudiation. You know, you talk about your problems and you say, yeah, look, that's so true. But you've got absolutely no intention of doing a thing about it. In verse 21, when a convenient day was come, that Herod on his birthday made a supper to his lords, high captains and chief estates of Galilee. That's the introduction. A convenient day had come. A convenient day for what? A convenient day for Herodias. You see, Herodias meditated John's murder day and night, and finally she settled on a day. This woman was very clever, very, very clever. Never underrate a woman, brethren. This woman had it worked out when Herod would be at his weakest, and she picked her day. Herod's birthday, or as it is, it's an anniversary, and it could have easily actually been the anniversary of his accession to the throne, which would have been the anniversary of the death of Herod the Great in about 4 BC. Whatever it was, he made a supper to all his lords, probably at Machaerus, at this fortress in which John was imprisoned, way, way below, many levels below in the dungeon. And there he gathered his high captains, his commanders, the very ones that later are going to be decisively defeated by Aretas, Emir of Arabia Petra. And along with them, he invited the chief estates of Galilee, the Galilean nobles, and there were some very rich nobles up in Galilee, who lived very well, and they moved in high circles, rubbing shoulders with none other than Herod himself. And they're all invited to this great celebration of Herod's accession to the throne. And on that day, verse 22, when the daughter of the said Herodias came in and danced, she pleased Herod. Now, Mark could have said, when Salome came in, but he didn't. He said, when the daughter of the said Herodias, because he wants to emphasize the chief architect of all this. And she danced and she pleased Herod greatly. To the extent that the king said unto the damsel, ask of me whatsoever thou wilt, and I will give it thee. You can only imagine what sort of oriental dance it was, and the way in which she pleased those men that were gathered together, and the ribald laughter as they became drunker and more drunk. And Herod, heated by wine, in verse 23, offers what is not even his to give. He says, swear to him, whatsoever thou shalt ask of me, I will give it to thee under the half of my kingdom. Well, really, he couldn't even give that much, because he owed his kingdom to Caesar. Herod had really lost his head, and Herodias' plot was working well. Salome, in verse 24, went straight to her mother, who'd orchestrated all of this. She asked her mother, what shall I ask? And she said, without hesitation, the head of John the Baptist. To Herodias, that was worth even more than half a kingdom. Because you see, John stood between her and greatness. John stood between her and the queenship which she held. She didn't want half the kingdom. She wanted the whole kingdom. And she knew that John was the great obstacle to all of that. But we know that John's blood was even more precious in the sight of God. For, says the prophet, precious, precious to Yahweh, in the sight of Yahweh is the death of his servant. So verse 25, Salome came straightway with haste unto the king. And in a book of imperatives, this has to be the most imperative of all the imperatives. She came straightway with haste unto the king and asked, saying, I will that thou give me by and by in a charger the head of John the Baptist. In actual fact, when it says by and by, it means not just in a little while, it means instantly, thank you. I will that you give me instantly the head of John the Baptist, and I'll have it on a platter. And so the head of John the Baptist, and this is the mind of Herodias, was to come forth at that feast as the piece de resistance. The final crowning dish of the feast would be this grisly item of John's head. And with that, I think even the battle-hardened warriors and captains of Herod's acquaintance were even shocked. So in verse 26, almost shocked back to sobriety, Herod finally knew what it meant to promise in haste and repent at leisure. He was, verse 26 tells us, exceedingly sorry. Yet for his oath's sake, and for their sakes which sat with him, he would not reject her. Herod had his pride. He had his dignity. And he didn't want to lose face in front of all the great men that sat around him. It would never do for a king, would it, to back down? It would never do for a king, having made an oath, to say, can't do that. It would look silly in the eyes of his subjects, in the eyes of the greatest of his subjects, in the eyes of the men he wanted to impress. There must have been an awful silence, and as Herod wrestled with his conscience, and finally he realised he was beaten. If he didn't, he lost. He lost faith. If he did, he lost. He lost John. And so for his oath's sake, and for the sake of those that sat with him, Herod agreed. And immediately, verse 27, and notice how this word is cropping up when people do things that are their spontaneous response to the drive of what is really is deepest in their heart. The true man comes forth. Immediately, the king sent an executioner, the speculatura. And again, it's not the Greek word for executioner, but it's a Greekized form of the Roman or Latin word, speculator, the executioner. Interesting, isn't it, that speculators originally were executioners. Those that are involved in the stock market. He sent the speculator, the executioner, and commanded his head be brought. And he went and beheaded him in the prison. In verse 28, he brought his head in the charger on the silver platter and gave it to the damsel. And the damsel gave it to her mother. And even the battle-hardened guests, as I said, looked on with horror and revulsion at the perverted and the brutal and bitter revenge of this woman. She got her way. But oh, what a cruel way she got it. The question, though, that arises stepping back from this whole account is, why is the death of John introduced at this point of the story? We're told about Christ coming to Nazareth, his rejection and the sending forth of the great gospel proclamation effort. And then we're told of the death of John. Why was it introduced at this time? Well, John was the friend of the bridegroom, the one who saw to all the preliminaries of the impending union. But he wouldn't speak to them, but rather from without he would stand and hear the bridegroom's voice and rejoice in the knowledge that his work was done and his joy was fulfilled. And so it was appropriate at this juncture, as the Lord's ministry grows and expands rapidly, that John should diminish. Knowing this, John said, "He must increase, but I must decrease." And as he kneeled on the cold floor of that dungeon in the terror, he did so with a full heart, though alone and defenceless in the end. And as he bowed his bare neck before the executioner braced above him, from afar he heard the voice of the bride and the bridegroom, and a quiet gladness diffused in his darkness. Far away in Galilee, the Son of God sent forth his disciples on their greatest preaching campaign ever. You can see why John thinks he's being touched with me. It's beautiful the way it all comes together. Verse 29, his disciples took up the corpse. They came and buried it in a tomb. And maybe it reflects some of Herod's remorse, but he at least allowed the disciples to take away the corpse. Meanwhile, In verse 30, another king gathers his nobles and his generals for consultation. Verse 30, the apostles gathered themselves together under Jesus and told him all things, that both what they had done and what they had taught. And so there is another consultation, another king with his generals and his commanders planning their campaign. And the Lord says, aware of the death of John, in verse 31, come ye yourselves apart into a desert place and rest a while. For there were many coming and going. And again we meet this expression, the desert place. It's the I'll get the word in a moment. Eremuno. It's the word from which we get hermit. Eremon. For he says that there are many coming and going. You see, it was nearing Passover time, and many sought him. And we're told that at this time they had no leisure so much as even to eat. Ironic, isn't it, brothers and sisters? Here's the Lord, and his first care is to draw his disciples away for a quiet time and to rest a while in a solitary place, the Eremus, the desert place. So here's another king with his great men, with his nobles, and they too gather together in the desert place. But this king has no party at this time. No, he's too busy for parties. He has no leisure, not so much as to eat. You see, in contrast to Herod, Christ's greatness is seen in that he worked for his people. Real kings are too busy for parties, brothers and sisters. And as we said earlier, when he was criticised by the Pharisees, they were probably unaware of how he fasted. He didn't just fast to impress. There were times when he went without food, hour on end, because he had better things to do. See how the ministry of the Lord is positive, it's proactive. But he doesn't just fast just to make a point or to persecute himself. If he goes without food, it's because he's got something better to do. And he always replaces a negative with a positive. And so he departed privately, in verse 32, into a desert place, seeking solitude, seeking a quiet moment to reflect upon what had transpired, the death of that great man John, his forerunner. But it was not to be, in verse 33. His desire was thwarted. For in verse 33, the people saw them departing, and many knew him, and ran afoot thither out of all cities, and outwent them, and came together unto him. And here, brothers and sisters, in verse 33, we have Christ's humanity candidly portrayed. We see that he's not always able to fulfill his intentions. Here's a man who knew the future, who had the Spirit of God, who had the power of God. Yet he wasn't always in control of the situation. Here's a time where you would think at last the Father would give him some solitude, some private time to himself. At least it was justified, for he'd just lost John. But no, his own desire is thwarted. Good though it might have been. And yet the Lord, showing the greatness of true kingship, turns reversal into advantage. And that's the mark of greatness. That's the mark of a true general and of a great leader. If you read the history of Europe and you have a look at the time of Napoleon, that's what really marked a man like Napoleon out, you know. Napoleon could be besieged on all sides by armies twice his size, twice the size of the French armies. Yet he always developed a technique for turning that disadvantage to advantage. And that's what marks out the average man from the outstanding leader. So the average man will say, well, give up. Surrender yourself to the situation. But not Napoleon. He'd perhaps be found by a lake. On one occasion, he was by this lake in Europe, and there was a fortress there on one hand with a garrison in it. And coming around the lake from either side were two armies, both twice the size of the army that he had. What was he going to do? Well, he left a detachment by the garrison. He rushed around the lake, defeated the army that was approaching him, grabbed their weapons that were left over, and then came back around in order to, in time to meet the other army coming round the other way, and defeated them too. And as the garrison realised what was happening, they came out all too late and got captured. And thus he turned what appeared to be a disadvantageous situation to an advantage. Divide and conquer was his method. Now here's the Lord, and he's no lesser general, he's greater. He's the great archetype of kingship. And here he is, in the wilderness, seeking solitude, justifiably so. But the people saw him, they recognised him, and they rushed after him. What's he going to do? How would you react? Well, verse 34, and Jesus, when he came out and saw much people, and was moved with compassion toward them, because they were as sheep, having not a shepherd, and he began to teach them many things. There's the greatness of Christ. How many men would have done that? His head was pounding, he was exhausted, he hadn't even eaten. He had no leisure so much as to eat. I know what I'd say. I'd say, well, look, I think I deserve a rest, please. There go, enough is enough. Plus, I've just lost a very close friend. Just have a bit of sympathy on me. No, not him. Look, Jesus, when he came out and saw much people, was moved with compassion for them. Now, that's a king for you. He doesn't think about himself. He thinks about his subjects. And he sees them as having a sheep without a shepherd. And we can imagine, as the distant figures milled about on the green hillsides, it evoked the same concern that Moses felt for the people of Israel in Numbers 27, when he asked for a man that could go out before Israel and lead them in, and lead them out, that they be not as sheep without a shepherd. And that phraseology, you know, came to carry over to the role of a king. When the people asked for a king, they asked for a king that might go out before them and lead them in. And that's what David, the beloved shepherd, did for Israel. And here's the greatest son of David. He looks over the hillside and he sees all these little figures dotted there in the distance, all heading towards him. And doesn't think, oh, what a pain. Oh, no, that's just what I needed. He says, look at all the sheep. They don't know where they're going. They're leaderless. They need a shepherd. And he gave them that leadership that they needed. They were leaders. They weren't going to find any leadership in Herod, were they? Feasting away in the Machaerus with all these great men, while all the rest of the people looked about for guidance, all the common people. No, they weren't going to find a shepherd in Herod, certainly not. Verse 35, and when the day was now far spent, his disciples came unto him and said, this is a desert place, and now the time is far past. Literally, in verse 35, when it says the day was now far spent, it is much time having already gone. The word time being aura, from which we can recognize hour. Much time is already gone. And this is a desert place. A desert place. So what are the disciples worried about? Time and place. Look, we've got a problem here. It's all very well your great ideals that you want to be a leader and help the people, and you can see that they're without a shepherd. But look, think about time and place. You've got to be practical. And so they mention it again at the end. They say, for the time is far past. You see, they're preoccupied with what they say are the realities of life. But you know, Christ is the really great leader. He's the man of vision. And it requires someone who's able to step out of commonplace to be a great leader. I remember actually Lawrence of Arabia, in the big opening of his book called The Seven Pillars of Wisdom, he said, most men, he said, dream at night. But he said, there's a few men that dream during the day. Such men are dangerous. They're the men of vision. And they plough ahead regardless of time and place, regardless of the practicalities of life. And somehow, miraculously, they succeed. They're the Napoleons of this world, the Lawrences of Arabia of this world, the Ord Wingate, you know, who basically laid the foundations for the Haganah and the Jewish army. That is bizarre things in the eyes of the average man. Their colleagues stared at them in disbelief. And here's Christ, in the same position, the greatest leader of all. Look, you know, wake up yourself. We've got to do something practically here. We've got a great crowd of people, 5,000 people. You know, it's way past tea time, and they're miles from home. What are you going to do? The cross shows that he's the greatest leader of them all, and he's beyond time and place. Jesus Christ, the same yesterday, today, and forever, says it, Paul in Hebrews. Verse 36, he says, does the apostle say to him, well, look, you better send them away, that they may go into the country round about and into villages and buy themselves bread, because they've got nothing to eat. Send them away. Is that what a true shepherd would do? No, Christ says, no, we can't do that. They've got to buy bread. It seems perhaps at this time that it's around about Passover time. All the evidence comes together to suggest that it's springtime and it's Passover. And so perhaps because the law forbade that there was any leaven to be carried on a person before Passover, they didn't have anything. Or secondly, because of the provision that nothing was to be eaten before the new harvest, before the offerings of the first fruits were given up, the people didn't have anything on them. Whatever's the case, the people were without bread. In verse 37, regarding them silently for a few moments, the Lord says, give ye then to eat. And here's one of these examples of the what might be described as the eccentricity of such great men, but actually what is the mark of true leadership and greatness. This is, why don't you give them something to eat? And they look at him aghast. Shall we go and buy 200 penny worth of bread and give them to eat? That'll be a year's wages on the calculations we can make from the Gospels. We haven't got a year's wages on us. You mean we're going to go and buy 200 penny worth of bread to feed this lot? Come on, be realistic. And again, ignoring their objection in verse 38, he continues. He says, well, how many loaves have you? And they sort of look at him blankly. He says, well, go and see. Go and find out how many you've got. When they knew, they come back and say, 5 and 2 fishes. So, it's interesting that as a great leader, Christ is also capable of making decisions, but also knowing when to delegate, you see? So he says to them, well, first of all, why don't you give them something to eat? They say, us? Come on, hang on a minute. There you go. He says, well, okay. You go and find out how many loaves and fishes we've got. Loaves, actually, in this case, of course. You go on. So he delegates, you see. So as a great ruler, he knows how to pass on responsibility. And having ascertained that there was 5 loaves and 2 fishes, he takes control of the situation in verse 39. And he commanded them to make all sit down by companies upon the green grass. So again, he throws the responsibility onto the 12 to organise it. He gives the command and he says, right, you 12 will go out and make them all sit down on the green grass. Make them sit down by companies on the green grass. And the Greek there is symposia. That's the word for companies, but it's a little Hebraism. It's symposia, symposia. And you'll find this occasionally in Mark's Gospel, that the word is repeated. It's in drinking parties. Symposia, symposia. That's what the word actually means. So now we've got another king, another group of nobles and generals, and another feast. But it's a contrast to the earlier feast, isn't it? Where they drank wine. Here Christ the King sits down with his disciples, his bride, and ultimately his own blood is to be the wine, isn't it? And they sit down upon the green grass. And here's one of those typical strokes of Mark's literary devices, that only Mark records that it's the green grass. Nobody else bothers with such a detail. Why tell us that it's the green grass? Well, in the previous study it said that it may very well reflect the fact that this is equivalent to the third day of the Father's creation. As the Father, so doth the Son. He is master of the seas, and the dry land appears. He heals legion, and now he seeks fruit. And Genesis explicitly says that when God gathered together the seas and made the land, he made the green grass to appear, and herb yielding seed and fruit. And so they sat down upon that green grass by ranks. Of course, at the same time, it tells us that if it was green grass, it must have been springtime. It must have been Passover. And there they sat by ranks in verse 40. And now here's another of those Hebraisms, those repetitions. It's not that they sat down by ranks. The word is prosai. But again, it's repeated. It's prosai, prosai. And this word prosai is the word that I mentioned in the last session that means garden beds. It's from the Greek for leeks. They'll leak it like an onion. They grow them in beds, in straight rows, in squares. So they're sitting down in squares, if you like, in garden beds. So it's got that double layer of meaning, which is so unique to the scriptures. And we're told they sat by numbers. And we're told what those numbers were, by hundreds and by fifties. So we can picture it, brethren and sisters. Here it is. They sat down. He commanded them to make all sit down by companies. Symposia, the drinking parties upon the green grass. And they sat down in the squares, the garden beds, by hundreds and by fifties. And we can imagine rows like a wedding feast. John, the friend of the bridegroom, has died. He's done his work. He's brought bride and groom together. And now for the feast. But this is a different kind of feast to the one that's just been held at the Cairo. He sits them down, Mark is quite explicit, by hundreds and by fifties. I wonder why he did that. We can understand that he set them down in rows that were 100 by 50. But why bother to tell us that? What purpose does it serve to Mark's theme and message? And what is there in Scripture that answers to 100 by 50? Well, I can only think of one thing. There it is. That's the only thing I know of in Scripture that is 100 by 50. The tabernacle. The tabernacle's dimensions, taking the outer court, were 100 long by 50 wide. Is there any significance in that? Why would he do that? For this reason, brethren and sisters, this is the first gathering, isn't it, of the incipient ecclesia, the new house of God. At the beginning of this chapter, what did we see? The Lord, for the last time, had entered into the synagogue, never to return again to his hometown or to the synagogue. In the same chapter, we find him laying the foundations of the new house of God, the true ecclesia of which this building and this structure was only typical. And so there is a double layer of fulfillment in this, brethren and sisters. And now, having sat them down, look how much time and trouble has been devoted by Mark to sitting these people down. He takes those five loaves and those two fishes, and with them he feeds that ecclesia. Let's now have a look at verse 41. And when he had taken the five loaves and the two fishes, he looked up to heaven and blessed and broke the loaves and gave them to his disciples to set before them, and the two fishes divided he among them all. When he had taken bread, and Jewish meals were conducted in a very formal and deliberate way. Very deliberately, as the master of the feast, the Lord takes that bread, presiding over the feast, at the head of this table, at the head of this ecclesia. He takes this bread as king over his people, and he holds the bread as if to identify with it. When he had taken the five loaves and the two fishes, he's holding them in his hands. What does he do next? Well, again, notice the literality of Mark. He looked up to heaven and praised. Because that's what the word blessed means, doesn't it? It means to praise God. He looked up to heaven and praised God. Why did he do that, brothers and sisters? Well, imagine that this group of people here is not 400, but 5,000. If he offered a prayer, would they all hear it? Of course not. But by his actions, and of course Mark is a book of action and incident, he showed exactly and unmistakably what he was doing. There was no mistaking what the Lord was doing as he took that bread and he looked up to heaven and he praised God for that bread. Everybody in that assembly knew what he was doing. A very clever man was the Lord. And then he broke the loaves. And this blessing and breaking of the loaves and giving to the disciples is an unmistakable anticipation of the same formula by which he presents the bread as the symbol of his own body broken for many at that Last Supper. This is the beginning, isn't it, of a pattern, brethren and sisters, as he stands and presides over that great feast, taking the bread, looking up to heaven, praising God. That becomes a formula which is finally to be worked out at the Last Supper itself. You see, brethren and sisters, how the Lord is very carefully laying a foundation. And as I said in the previous study, this is part of a pattern that prepared. And it occurs a number of times that he feeds with bread. He then disappears, only to return and to rebuke his disciples for often their lack of faith and unbelief. And the bread becomes the token, the reminder of his presence. Because we find in chapter 8 that when they fail to have faith, he says, why is it that you fail to understand? How is it you do not remember? For you were not conscious of the miracle of the loaves. And the word miracle is not there. He says, you are not conscious of the loaves. You considered not the loaves. You see how significant the loaf had become to him. This is no light thing, brethren and sisters. It's very deliberate and very careful, and he is sowing something in their mind. A pattern which is then going to be invoked at the very last when he returns again from the grave. So in one act, he breaks the bread. And in one act, he encompassed all that was involved in the manufacture of bread. Sowing, watering, growing, ripening, harvesting, threshing, grinding, and baking. In one movement, he encompasses all that is involved in the making of bread. And that word break, brothers and sisters, is katalu, to break down. It's a strong compound word, and it really means to constantly and continually break. He kept breaking and breaking and breaking and breaking and breaking. And he continued, brethren and sisters, to break and break that bread until there was far more than was ever needed to feed that 5,000 people. Far beyond what they needed. And verse 42 tells us that they did all eat and were filled. But Psalm 22 and verse 26, that tells us And Psalm 22, you'll remember, is that monumental psalm concerning the crucifixion of our Lord. And at the end of his work, the psalm prophesies that the meek shall eat and be satisfied. This is what this symbolizes. So much bread did he break that in verse 43 we're told they took up 12 baskets full of the fragments and of the fishes. 12 baskets, and the word here is kophoni, the wicker baskets carried by the Jews to prevent their food from being polluted by heathens. 12, the number of Israel. And again, it's teaching us the lesson that it's to the Jew first. Later there's going to be another feeding, and they do take away baskets as that too, but it's a different word for baskets. It's not the kophoni, it's the string basket. It's a different word. But here it's 12 baskets, the number of Israel, illustrating the fact that Christ would not destroy, but he'd fill up all that pertained to the law and to the prophets. So these baskets, these kophoni, the wicker baskets, are filled with fragments. And you'll notice that, as I've said, every word of the scriptures is carefully weighed. Not a word is wasted. We're not told that there were 12 baskets of bread, but there were 12 baskets of fragments, placing the emphasis upon the breaking. This is my body that is broken for you. And I, by the way, have no problem with saying that the body of the Lord was broken. It's a different matter from saying that a bone was broken, as the scriptures say. Not a bone of him was broken. His body was broken, brethren and sisters. He was broken in the same way as we should be before our Father. A broken and a contrite spirit is acceptable with God. But they filled these 12 baskets with these broken fragments. And you'll see that there's a frugality in the divine economy. Nothing is wasted. What's that teaching us, brethren and sisters? Why would they bother to go around and pick up all these pieces? And he just sent his disciples quite carefully to go and do that. And we can imagine them running around after the feast, picking up every little bit. Was it because the Lord didn't want to pollute the place? He didn't believe in pollution? That he was ecologically sensitive? No. There's bound to be a lesson in this, isn't there? And the lesson is that there's this frugality in the divine economy. The sacrifice of God's Son would not be wasted. And like the manna in the tabernacle, which had to be constantly renewed, this bread, brethren and sisters, has and will be kept for years and years. It's kept for 2,000 years. Because the meaning and the significance of that bread continues and continues on to be appreciated by communities around the world like ourselves gathered here today. There were 5,000 fed at that time, we're told, in verse 44. They that did eat of the loaves were about 5,000 men. You see, the 5 original loaves, the number of grace, had been multiplied 1,000 times. Here's grace that abounds. The one offering sufficed for all people, for all time. In verse 45, straightway the Lord now constrains his disciples to get into the ship and to go to the other side before unto Bethsaida, while he sent away the people. Straightway the Lord constrains the disciples to get away. He sends away the people. Why did he send the disciples away and then send the people away? Well, this sudden urgency to send the people away is explained in other Gospels by the fact that they tell us that the people desired to make him king after this. But what did he do? Did he lead an army to Rome? Did he sack Jerusalem? Did he overthrow Herod and Machaerus? He got his disciples out of it. He got them out of the way of temptation because they would have been vulnerable. Don't forget where those disciples came from. Half of them were zealots from war, from the north, from Galilee. And they would have been susceptible to such a movement. He packed them into a boat and he sent them off. There's leadership for you, because he knew that they were in temptation's way. And then he drove the people away from him He sent them away. And here's a dramatic contrast again with Herod. This is what how that we see that Christ is qualified to be the king of the world. He too had held a feast in the desert for his friends. The climax of the feast of Herod in the palace of Machaerus had been the presentation of the head of John on a platter, slain to legitimise an unlawful union. The climax of Christ's feast was the symbolic serving of the body of the king himself for his betrothed. No wonder this moment was marked by the seating of the people in the shape of that tabernacle to indicate the birth of the new house of God. Well, now we come to the end of the story. There's one little detail to be wrapped up. What of Herod? What happened to Herod after this? Well, driven by the ambition of Herodias, who was jealous of Agrippa, who you'll remember from the Acts of the Apostle had been made king, Herodias urged Antipas, Herod Antipas, to make his way to Rome, and there to put his case to Caesar that he might be made king. Unfortunately for him, he met up with none other than Caligula, that mercurial and irrational and irascible Caesar. You know, the sort of guy that liked to dress up as a charioteer and ride around the circus to enjoy the spectacle of the bloodletting of the gladiatorial circus. And the Emperor Caligula, known for his unpredictable moods, promptly deprived Herod of all his dominions and banished him to Lyons in France. The only thing, brethren and sisters, that stands to Herodias' credit is that she went with him. Meanwhile, back by the sea, we find the other king sending away his subjects that they should not make him king, sending away his bride to prevent her from taking him by force and making him a king. This story is just so full, isn't it? It's rich with ironic contrast. So what do we learn from this story? How can we sum up the characteristics of Christ that we've seen? We can learn these things from Christ's visit to Nazareth and the feeding of the 5,000. We've seen the large-mindedness of Christ, that Christ was able to accept the rejection at Nazareth, knowing that the cause is greater than the individual. When you get a king that knows the cause is greater than the individual, he's not susceptible, is he? He's not susceptible to the attack of pride. He's not, therefore, going to be susceptible to bribery and corruption, because this man lives for a higher cause than himself. The second thing we saw was his flexibility and his selflessness. Seeking solitude to mourn John, Christ as a true shepherd and king saw the need of the people as greater than his own and was moved with compassion for them. And there's a mark of greatness in a man: flexibility. Too often, brethren and sisters, we're not able to change for the circumstances. We've got our own agenda, and it's very, very hard to deviate from that. But the Lord was able to be quick on his feet in the new challenges that a situation might bring to him. And even though he might have been justified in looking for that quietness, doubtless to pray to his Father, he saw that the need of the people was greater than his own. He was moved with compassion for them. There's the mark of kingship. And finally, meekness is the fruit of real power. Christ never bothered to prove his claims at Nazareth. He could have flaunted his power, and everybody would have been wowed when they saw how clever he was and how brilliant he was and how marvellous these healings were that he'd done in other towns. He didn't do it. And nor did he pursue the crown later on, after feeding the 5,000. Why?
Because of this, brethren and sisters, true greatness has got nothing to prove. If you're really great, you don't have to run around telling people. You don't have to run around proving it. It'll naturally be demonstrated. This man knew that there was one greater than he, who had appointed him to be king of the world. All he needed to do was to manifest his Father in heaven.